Hello, friends. We are back of episode 139 of the Our Weekly Holidays podcast. My name is Eric Nance, and for once, I actually think I'm done with traveling for the foreseeable near term. So it's great to be back at the home base and recovering a bit from some pretty influential conferences that I may be touching on a bit later on. But as always, I'm very delighted that you are joining us from wherever you are listening around the world to share our take on the latest issue of the Our Weekly Project. And of course, I do not ever do this alone anymore, and I'm joined by my awesome co-host, Mike Thomas. Mike, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well, Eric. Yes, I think conference season is starting to wrap up for me as well, and we'll get into the sort of final sprint of the year here. I know you have all sorts of exciting projects that you're working on, and we have a lot of exciting stuff going on as well, but nothing is ever quite as exciting as the Our Weekly Highlights.
That's a highlight in the name for a reason, buddy. It always has been. And by the way, as we're recording this, it may go out a day later, but happy National Podcast Day. Just give yourself a celebratory, you know, beverage or whatnot after this, Mike. Yes, and we're still keeping the train rolling. So that's one of the best parts of doing podcasting is consistency. So better or for worse, we're always here. So, but you know what's also always here is Our Weekly itself. And the issue this week was curated by Rio Nakagawara, with tremendous help, as always, from our fellow Our Weekly team members and contributors like all of you around the world with your pull requests and other recommendations for awesome R content that we can talk about. And leading up is a space that I haven't had a lot of play with recently, although, ironically, it was only a couple days ago that I had a respected colleague at the day job ask for my input on how to perform a pretty messy set of joining of data frames where things aren't always matching up as they seem. And now we've had some packages that do offer this support for what are called fuzzy joins, which if you haven't heard that term before, and I admit it's kind of been new to me. It's when you're joining, say, two data sets with a column that should be consistent, but there are some discrepancies in, say, spelling or words or whatnot, but contextually it should be able to match up. Well, there is a new R package that has hit the R universe, literally, called Zoomer Join. Zoomer Join is authored by Benigno Green, who is a pre-doctoral fellow at Yale University. And the selling point of Zoomer Join is that you can now perform fuzzy joins with very large data sets, with very little memory usage, and it's powered by some very nice high-performance implementations of what's called locality-sensitive hashing. Apparently, this is an algorithm that, again, I've never heard of this before, this package, that lets you match records between data sets without having to compare, and I'm reading this from the vignette, all possible pairs of observations, which means that you get a lot of increase in speed and performance. And just how, what is the back end of Zoomer Join? Well, it is, wait for it, Rust. We're seeing Rust really take a headstrong, you know, foothold in some really high-performing packages in the R community. We've actually mentioned it in previous episodes, some of the great asynchronous extensions, the Plumber, that we're seeing in Rust, and now we're seeing this in the joining of data frames as well. It obviously means that you will need a Rust compiler installed on your system to be able to install this package. Benigno does a great job of outlining what you exactly need to do in that space if you're new to this. But this package is actually hosted on the R universe, so I meant that literally for a reason. So this should take care of a very simple installation process, binary format, which is awesome for easier installation. Then once you have the package, you'll see that the big, you know, the major user-facing functions that you'll interact with are prefixed with either Jacquard or Euclidean for the different types of fuzzy joining you can do. There's more details in the package vignettes on what's kind of under the hood of these particular algorithms, but they should be kind of drop-in replacements for your other calls, say in dplyr, of like left join, right join, inner join, or full join. It'll have equivalents of that that are supported by Zoomer Join. And of course, you want to see kind of how this performs in practice. So There is a great introductory vignette that talks about joining a row of two data sets that are based on this database of ideology, money, and politics and elections. So very real world type example. The data set has like 500,000 rows, so it's definitely not a trivial size for sure. But he does do some benchmarking to compare that from the start time to performing a join. And it took, at least according to this vignette, about 5 seconds to join that. That's much quicker than you might see in a typical join operation. So I think that's getting some really nice performance enhancements real quick. And as he said, it looks like it does do some, you know, memory optimization as well. So if you're concerned about this overloading your memory usage in your R session when you're joining these multiple large data sets together, that Zoomer Join is going to have you covered to minimize that memory footprint as well. So there's a lot of detailed benchmarks in another vignette, as well as a more hands-on guided tour of the syntax and kind of what's going on under the hood of it. So I think this is great if you're in this space, and I'm really encouraged to see where Zoomer Join goes in the future.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Eric. I think this is a really cool package. You know, I think in the past, folks, including myself, might be used to using the fuzzy join package. I think that was originally authored by David Robinson. I took a look at the GitHub for that R package. It looks like it hasn't necessarily been touched in a few years. So this might be a more up-to-date alternative in terms of the R ecosystem. It uses a high-performance algorithm called locality-sensitive hashing, which is probabilistic by default. So it's going to use a probability that the match that a match took place. And I think by default, that joining takes place when the chance of a true match being discovered is at least 95%. But that is the default. There are hyperparameters as well. In particular, there are a couple functions called Jaccard probability, Jaccard hypergrid search, and I imagine that there's equivalent functions if you are computing those similarities using Euclidean distance as well. So a lot of nice options here. It almost feels a little machine learning, you know, when you start to talk about tuning hyperparameters to create these fuzzy joins. But from what I remember on doing this type of fuzzy joining, you know, it's much more difficult than joining two vectors together that have, you know, exactly equivalent values in them, and you're sort of getting perfect joins. You're having to measure that similarity first and then perform the joins as well. So it is expensive to take place. And the fact that this package is able to execute these fuzzy joins across hundreds of thousands of rows, hundreds of thousands of comparisons, you know, you're multiplying that space out for each individual row in your first vector, right? You're comparing that to every single row in the second vector and trying to figure out what the best join is. So in order to do that, you know, you're getting into orders of magnitude of comparisons compared to the original input vector. And the fact that this Rust implementation is able to do this on data sets of that size in only 5 seconds is pretty incredible. So I think this is a well-timed package to hit the R ecosystem. I think this is a really handy set of utilities. I think it's very clear that the functions and the arguments to those functions are really well-written, well-designed, and things like that. So hats off to Beniamino for putting this package together, and I'm excited to see it hit the R universe, I guess.
So yeah, as I mentioned, this was a timely topic or a timely highlight in itself, because I have a colleague in the IT group at my organization that is trying to perform a fuzzy join on trying to link the names of GitHub repositories with who is actually the owner of that project. And that metadata is captured in a separate database that is pretty messy. And it's a very intricate operation to try and link all that together, where ideally it would have that metadata captured somewhere in the kind of like hidden fields or whatnot, but she's going to have to perform a lot of fuzzy joining in this space. She might be listening to this right now, so I warned her I might plug her this in the episode when I discovered this package. So I've actually pointed her to this package, and we'll see if it helps out with some pretty massive data sets of metadata from GitHub and metadata from this other system where we're trying to track who actually owns what, who is like a system owner or a system custodian or whatnot. The joys of enterprise and linking these disparate data sets together. But I think this is a very helpful toolbox or a package in the toolbox of those that are dealing this routinely. And yeah, I'm really excited to see where it goes.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think we have use cases pretty quickly here as well. We have one client that works with banks, and they receive data about those banks' customers and address data specifically. And you would be surprised how different the address that a particular customer supplies when they sign up for a bank account can be from actually what the USPS here in the United States recognizes for an address. So there's a lot of fuzzy joining work that we do for that particular client that needs to take place. So I am very excited to potentially bring this into that use case.
Yeah, because in the real world, there's no such thing as perfectly clean data. You've got to get your hands dirty one way or another.
Totally agreed.
Well, Mike, it's never in our weekly episode without at least some form of either visualization or mapping or a combination of both to talk about. And our next highlight comes from Nicola Rennie, who is a frequent contributor in this space with her visualizations of Tidy Tuesday data sets recently. But also she's had a lot of adventures in visualization in general. And in her latest blog post, she talks about creating a map with ggplot2, which, of course, that's been done quite a bit, but a map in the style of being created completely with a typewriter. What is that all about, you ask? Well, apparently she saw a blog post by RJ Andrews where he made a map of California, but literally using a typewriter to do it. Like a real typewriter. We're talking the vintage typewriters that you might see at a museum these days. But I'm old enough to remember having one around the house, so just saying. She was inspired to see just how far we could go with using R to do that. So, of course, to start, we got to get our data to actually do the map of California. And there's some nice previous data sets that she's leveraging from a 30-day map challenge that has the latitude, longitude, and other elevation metrics that are read as shape files in the R using the SF package, which is a big player in this space. I'm learning more from these highlights every week if we talk about mapping. So with the longitudinal latitude shape in place, the next step is to get the elevation data. And there is an elevator R package, great name, of course. And apparently you can grab this elevation data from the AWS Open Data Terrain Tiles and the Open Topography Global Datasets API. That's a mouthful, but hey, guess what? You can use R to get it all. So looks like once you get that package set up, you're able to grab that elevation in the raster layer object and then grab that into each square that you have in your grid of the map. So you could be done there and just do a nice map with that information in ggplot2. But now, as we mentioned, she wanted to do this in the typewriter style that she saw from RJ Andrews. And that's where, okay, now how do we find a font to use? So like many, she was leveraging Google Fonts because often it has a very wide selection of fonts that we can use. And then R has great tie-ins to that with using the sys fonts and the show text package to display that in ggplot2. And she found the Spatial Elite Google font. As you'll see in the blog post, you can see that that font looks pretty darn similar to what you get in those vintage typewriters. And then once she was able to process that into R, and then it's a little more tidyverse magic to put that into ggplot2, making sure that she had the characters sequences in place to make sure that it would fit the style of the map. And then making sure that, again, it's a little more mutating, a little more joining of the custom like character mapping data sets she had to create. And then lo and behold, you fold that into ggplot with a little clever use of geom text, and then making sure that she reverses the axes correctly, and then little modifications to the scales, making sure that the theme is voided so that we just have the map itself, putting a little label on it. And there you go. You've got a nice map of this. And she did actually Scotland for this. So looks really cool. Like if you printed that out as a paper and you handed it to me, Mike, and said that, guess what, Eric, I was feeling really retro and I gave you a map of Scotland or whatnot, I'd be like, okay, give me that typewriter. I want to try it too. But no, this is done in R itself. So kudos to Nicola for pulling this off. There's a lot of, like I said, great mapping magic, but also a lot of clever use of the font and making sure that that is playing nicely with the boundaries and the different shades of elevation to really give you those, maybe long for the days of dot matrix printers and typewriters from yesteryear. So another clever use of where you can take visualization. So another mind-blowing moment in R Weekly itself. I just love that we can do all this, again, with all open source software. So awesome stuff here.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. This is such a cool blog post. And I think there was either some talks or workshops or just sort of sessions at PositConf in Chicago a couple of weeks ago on artistry, right? It's doing art with the R programming language. And that is so cool to see that sort of topic rear up so much within the community, because I know there's a lot of folks that are interested in it. To me, it sort of started out as a niche thing back on Twitter when Twitter sort of was the place to be, and I would always see some folks within the art community creating some incredible art, essentially, whether it be generative or whether it be sort of intentional, like Nicola's doing right here, to create something specific. It's really incredible to see how folks use the language for all sorts of different things. And one thing that was really cool here in Nicola's post is that in terms of all of the points, if you will, on this chart, they're made up of the four letters. So a lowercase L, an uppercase I, an uppercase H, and an uppercase M. So those are essentially typed on screen like you would a typewriter, and they sort of layer on top of each other to make up this plot. It's really incredible. It's very neat to think about. It's something that I don't think I would have ever thought about, but it's really cool that she took sort of this use case and this idea that she had and really put pen to paper here and fingers to keyboard and created these plots and shows us sort of the evolution from the original data coming in and talking about how raster data comes into a data frame with the coordinates reversed. So she had to make sure that she reversed the coordinates so that Scotland wasn't upside down in the image that she put together. And then, you know, slowly sort of adjusting the fonts that you're talking about, both for the font of these four letters that are being typed out within the chart, as well as the title of the chart as well, adjusting the color of these four letters that are getting printed on screen to something that's more gray and less black. And then, like you said, adjusting the other theme parameters within ggplot to take away all the axes and sort of just leave this map on the page at this grayscale with this really cool font for the title that just says Scotland. It looks like it's 100 years old. It looks like something that you found in your grandparents' attic that you pull out and you're like, wow, this is super cool. I want to hang on to this, or I want to frame this somewhere in my house. So I hope Nicola does that, maybe prints this out and puts it someplace in her office or in her house, because I think it is just that cool. And obviously at the end, as in most of this type of work that she blogs about, she has a nice feature of the final print that has all of her social media links and social media icons right below the map, and a nice link to her previous blog post that shows exactly how to do that. Because I think if you're someone who finds yourself creating content like this, you know, especially sort of ggplot or visualization type of content, I think it's important to ensure that you are putting your handles somewhere such that, you get credit, and then folks can check out the rest of your work if you're interested in, sort of putting that out there for the community and, generating buzz around the work that you do. So another fantastic blog post from Nicola. I think she's cranking out content almost every week, it seems like, whether she's featured in the highlights in the top three or, if she's somewhere or else and we're catching a blog post by her. So this is another great feature, and I would certainly encourage any folks interested in, data visualization with R to, check it out.
Absolutely. And a couple of thoughts that came into my mind as you were talking through that. First, can you imagine having this on one of those postcards that you create with Jacqueline Knowles's GG IRL package? I mean, talk about vintage way to give a little flavor to a postcard. This will be a great combo for that. And also, just what Nicole is doing in general, I'm just so glad that she's sharing her knowledge with us on these topics. And it's a little diversion, but I actually pulled up a blog post from earlier this year when she talked about going back to Qordle for a bit, making really top-notch, pretty-looking PDFs of Qordle. I actually used her blog post to write a custom letter that I'm about to send to my friends at Jupiter Broadcasting, a little, I'll call value for value, a submission to them. So, Nicola, keep rocking with sharing this knowledge to us, because you never know where it's going to be used, and we have lots of great uses for it.
Yeah, and I think you could even start with baby steps, right? If you have always used the default font for your ggplots, try checking out the Google fonts someday and see if you find one that looks, you know, interesting to you, given the project that you're working on, how formal or, informal it is, and just try changing the font within your text on, your plot, whether that be the title or, annotations, things like that within your plot, and see, you know, what sort of additional value that can provide you within that project that you're working on.
Well, if you recall, in our first highlight of this episode, we were talking about the very innovative Zoomer Join package, which, of course, had a, you might call, system dependency on Rust. And that is a trend that we're seeing quite a bit of packages leveraging other utilities out there to help power their processing. Well, in general, this has been, at least in my past experience, a bit of a thorny issue to deal with, especially in custom, you might say, more hamstrung Linux environments of trying to get that right system dependency installed on your Linux-based system. Doesn't tend to happen as much on the Windows and Mac side, because sometimes those are distributed binary from the start, and they end up bundling, say, that SSL library or whatnot. But our last highlight is talking about some of the newer ways that we can take advantage of new tooling to help with the automated installation, at least in most cases, with getting that system dependency installed for an R package in the confines of, say, an automated testing workflow. This comes from Hugo Grusin, directly from the R-Hub blog, where he talks about, you know, getting what is required for a package to declare that it needs another system dependency. So if you ever inspect the description file of that package that you like to use that you know is depending on another utility, you will see a field in the description called System Requirements. What's interesting is behind this, the actual label that people will use, the package authors will use, is free text. You could write it however you want, but that might give somebody nightmares, so to speak, of trying to parse that effectively and trying to figure out, okay, what exactly does that mean? It may put a version number afterwards. It might put the lib prefix in front of it. Who knows what they'll label it as? So how do you actually figure out what that is, what that's supposed to be? Well, the good news is there are a lot of brilliant people in the community that have been trying to figure out ways to efficiently process this system requirements field. And just how is this possible? Well, that is thanks to, in the example that he puts in the blog post of a GitHub action, you will see there isn't a lot there for respect to system dependency installation. It seems to be baked in somewhere. Well, yes, it is, because there is a action setup called Setup R Dependencies. That is going to be piggybacking off of the pack package. which is a very powerful package in the context of installation of art packages themselves, as well as trying to figure out what system dependencies a package needs. And the, one of the important features of PAC, amongst many others, is that it has a call to find the system requirements for a package, which then piggybacks off of another package called package depends that actually go through what that system requirement actually is. And apparently there is a crowdsourced version of this list of each of these packages and what system level libraries that they require that is maintained by R-Hub itself. They have a repository called System Requirements. And in this, there is a set of JSON files and other files that actually spell out for a given package what is that system library that's needed, say, on different distributions of Linux and other architectures. Boy, this would have been great to have like many years ago, but hey, better late than never. So Hugo gives an example in the blog post of what some of this JSON format looks like in the context of, say, NVIDIA and the CUDA libraries that you might need for a package that depends on a GPU and it's running, say, on Ubuntu, one of the more popular Linux distributions. What's interesting is there's also some regex behind this as well to deal with that, as I said, free text that can occur in that description field. So once it finds a match for that, then it's going to have a more, you know, targeted label of that system dependency that you might have to install via, say, the apt package manager in Ubuntu or whatnot. And this action is going to take care of all that. Again, thanks to the machinery that PAC and package depends is wrapping to find and discover what that system library actually is. Now, it's great when that works automatically. And in fact, it does have a very high success rate from what I've seen in the community. But it's not always going to be that way. Now, there may be an esoteric-ish library that has not had the right regex in place to figure out what that free text field might actually mean for that library. Well, the best part, the way that you can help if you encounter this, is submit a pull request to that aforementioned repository that is tracking all the different regex patterns and what these actual system libraries represent. That's a terrific way to give back to the community if you're going to encounter this issue and making sure that users in the future, and frankly future you, will be able to depend on the package, pack package and package depends to actually help install this. Now, even then, it may have some really esoteric requirements, and you do have to actually install it manually. Well, the good news is that you can run commands in a GitHub action. Maybe you have to download this utility literally from the source. Maybe it's a GitHub repo or whatnot, and then compile it yourself in that GitHub action. So you can run arbitrary, you know, system shell commands in this action when you really have to do that. And he points to a real life example of doing this in the RBI R package, which I haven't used before, but this can happen. And then another approach, if you're in the container world, like I've been diving into recently, is using a custom Docker image in your GitHub action that would take care in that image of having all the dependencies installed. That's obviously an additional level of complexity if you're new to Docker. But what's interesting about this is that these GitHub actions really are containers running on Microsoft's cloud environment. So being able to give it a Docker image to base its installation off of, then you can really control that full stack of that automated testing paradigm of what packages are actually being installed. So again, that's where you have more control, but there is more of an upfront dev cost to make that happen. So again, a terrific overview by Hugo on this post here. And he gives credit to Miles Salmon, who has also been heavily involved in the R-Hub project, and Gabor Sardi, again, one of the engineers in this space of R-Hub and other intersections, for reviewing this post. But again, it's a great primer if you've been kind of very confused about how you can deal with system dependencies in your package workflows. This is an excellent overview of what's possible and how far we have come in the R community to make this hopefully as seamless as possible for you. But even when it's not seamless, you've got some solutions to play with here.
Yeah, this is a phenomenal write-up by Hugo. And dependency management is hard, right? Just dependency management of our packages themselves and avoiding namespace collisions and things like that is hard enough. And then on top of that, you know, we have to think about system dependencies as well on that particular operating system that we need sort of before we can even do anything with these R packages that we want to install. So it's tricky. But like you said, I really appreciate one, Hugo putting together a really holistic blog post here about all the different paths that you could potentially go down, things that you might run into and how to troubleshoot some of those issues, you know, including if you really have to within your GitHub action, you can write an apt-get call and you can run whatever you need to run to install it yourself, as well as, you know, try to contribute to the team that's trying to make things easier for you if you do sort of run into an issue. You know, I can hear Bruno Rodriguez right now shouting into the void about how if you use Nix, not necessarily that it's a void, sorry Bruno, we are listening. Shouting how if you use Nix, you don't necessarily have to worry about any of this stuff. I can hear Dirk Elbutel saying that if you just use the R2U Docker image, I think a lot of the system dependency management is taken care of for you there as well. Pretty sure about that. You might have to fact check me on that. But it's tricky. I think, you know, GitHub Actions and Docker really enable us to have much more control over that, but it is another skill that you have to learn, right? And, you know, I know, Eric, that you tend to use what's called dev containers, which are essentially Docker-based, a way to Dockerize your environment during development, such Absolutely. That it makes it quite easy to port that, right? Because you have a Docker file that's necessary to create that dev container and do your local development. So you already have that when it comes time to deploy that code someplace else. So it makes that transition, in my opinion, super seamless. And I think that's a great workflow. I guess one of my questions here is around the pack package. I admittedly have never really used the pack package before. And I'm wondering if you have used it before and how that fits into your dev container workflow, if at all.
Yeah, actually, I don't have a lot of day-to-day usage of it, but I am seeing it kind of being wrapped by other packages in this space. And in fact, more recent versions of renv, which for those that haven't heard that, that is a way to give yourself, you know, control over package versions in your R project offered by Kevin Ushe at Posit. I think it is actually wrapping pack under the hood now for its package installation. So I have been using it kind of by proxy. It is very reliable. I mean, certainly it is, you know, quite performative and involves, or it supports kind of parallel installation of packages. So you're not just doing them all sequentially. And now, luckily at my day job, our Linux environment does typically have most of the dependencies I need for these custom package installations. But I think that is one of the best selling points of pack is the fact that it hooks directly with finding that for you in these other environments. With respect to my dev container setup, I haven't used pack directly. I'm actually leveraging, you mentioned Dirk Elbutel. He's got kind of in these Rocker images that I'm basing my dev containers off of, a set of scripts that are pre-baked in from the Lidler utility where you can have a simple call like install.r and then the name of package, and it kind of just does the binary package install using the Posit package manager, the open source Posit package manager under the hood. But certainly you could easily use pack in that instead. There's just whatever you prefer. But in the end, it's still a very helpful utility in this space.
Yeah, I agree. And I think a lot of the work that I've seen, you know, looking actually in GitHub at maybe Tidy Models code or Tidyverse code, or taking a look at a lot of the work that the Posit team does, like you mentioned the renv package, I do see the pack package being leveraged in the source code of those repositories quite often by the Posit team. So to me, that sort of starts to indicate that's my little red flag that goes up that says, hey, you know, you might want to start checking that out a little bit further. And one thing that I learned in this blog post, you know, like we talked about, was that it does have functions within that package that help you identify what those system requirements are for the packages that you're working with. And that's pretty incredible. That's something that we don't necessarily have in base R library calls, things like that. So that's definitely a leg up in terms of making it easier for us to understand what the system dependencies are that we need to install on that production system to ensure that everything runs smoothly.
Yeah, and I'm not even sure, again, I may be pleading ignorance here, if other languages have that kind of, you know, extensibility too with respect to inspecting that particular package you're trying to install, let's say from a PyPI or even the NPM that needs another system dependency, that the user might say in the README or the developer documentation that, hey, we're using this utility, but it can automatically grab that on a Linux-based environment. I think we're pretty lucky here, so I'm definitely excited to see where this goes in the future.
It's good to be an R user another day.
Another day and another fantastic day at that. And what else is fantastic? This R Weekly issue itself, and Rio's done another great job of curating a boatload of new packages, updated packages, and a bunch of great resources across the real world usage of R, academia, and great tutorials. And we'll take a couple minutes for our additional finds here. And I'm going to have a little fun with this, but Julia Silge, who's been frequently sharing some awesome screencasts of her use of, say, tidy models and other modeling pipelines in R, she has a very entertaining screencast about the concept of bootstrap confidence intervals for how often a certain character named Roy Kent from the Ted Lasso show says... it's a PG podcast. Oh, we got to clean that up. Yes, but watch the video. It is hilarious, but also a very educational hilarious at the same time. And a great companion to that, it's not in the highlights specifically, but I want to call this out, is that PositConf. A good friend, Deepsha Mangani, gave a great presentation of how Qortal, you can leverage, say, Plotly animations. And guess what? She was doing a very interesting meta-analysis across all the seasons of Ted Lasso on how that same character said, you know what. So have fun watching that. Learn some great content along the way, too.
Eric, I didn't even know you knew that word. I've never heard anything so filthy come out of your mouth. That's terrible. But we have to power through here. So I guess, yeah. I'll talk about the, I'll try to forget that and try to talk about the additional highlights that I had found. I'll call out two really quickly. One was an interview with Javier Araca-Decuz, with the R Consortium. I was fortunate enough to meet Javier at PositConf. What a incredibly nice guy. We had a few different conversations during PositConf. It's, you know, it's sort of a whirlwind there trying to meet people and spend time talking to folks that you've talked to through social media for years and things like that, but haven't had the chance to meet in person. But he was as kind, if not more, in person as he was through our prior conversation. So Javier, if you're listening out there, it was great to meet you. And he concludes that interview, which talks about his journey from finance to now working at Centene, which is in healthcare, building predictive health models. And he talks about, you know, one final call to action that he has. If you're trying to educate other coworkers about modern use cases for R, he recommends starting an internal R user group at your company. He did that at Centene, and between 2019 and 2020, I think it grew from 10 people to over 100 people. So that's pretty incredible. It seems like they have a really nice R culture there at Centene, thanks to a lot of the work that he's done. And maybe the second blog post that I'll highlight really quickly is another edition of Mel Salman's three R functions that she enjoys. Two that I'll call out quickly here are the sprintf function, which is in base R. If you are used to using the glue package to really neatly sort of glue vectors or character strings together, but you are in a use case where you don't want to add that dependency of glue to your project and you want to find something similar that's within base R, the sprintf function can help you with that. So that's always a useful one for me on the occasional project where I'm not necessarily importing glue, or I have a use case where there's only one really tiny little part of my project where I would like to use glue, but I don't want to bring the whole entire package in just for that one line. So I try to tend to take a look at base R functions that can do equivalent things, and the sprintf function is certainly one in that case that can behave quite similarly to glue. The other one is one that I've talked about on the podcast, I think, before. It's one of my favorite base R functions. It's called append, and it allows you to append values from one vector to another vector very easily. It's really intuitive, very cool. You don't have to use paste or anything like that. It's very easy to work with, a really nice syntax. And one thing that I didn't even realize was that it has an argument called after, which allows you to essentially append the values from the second vector into a particular place within the first vector. Instead of just tacking them onto the end, you could essentially append those values after, you know, the first or second character string within that original character vector, if it's, you know, five characters long or something like that, and stick those values you're appending in the middle of it, as opposed to tacking them on to the end. So that was really cool. I'm always, you know, super interested to sort of just dig into these little niche base R functions. And I learn something new every day in Mel's blog post. So maybe you will too.
Yeah, likewise. Every time I see Mel has a blog post, that's going in my browser tab immediately, so I can see what I can take from that as well. So yeah, great resources mentioned there. I met Javier at the St. PositConf as well. I'm really, really excited to talk with him, and he's very enthusiastic about growing their R user base as well. So I remember when I saw that interview, I immediately gave him big congrats on that interview. So very, very entertaining read there. And yes, we hope you enjoyed, listening to us banter about what we're excited about in this R Weekly issue. But there's always more to talk about, but we just don't have enough time. So in closing, we're going to, of course, plug where you can find all this great information. That's rweekly.org. You'll see the latest issue there. Of course, the whole entire back catalog, if you will, of issues is ready for you as well. And we love to get contributions from all of you. So please send your pull request. It's all marked down all the time on this upcoming issues draft. We'd love to hear from you. We love to have your contributions. And I also put in the supplements of this episode, you've heard me mention this concept of value for value a bit. And I admit I'm trying to find better ways of explaining it. But luckily, there's a great podcaster out there named Kyron, who's done a terrific job with a new, not that new podcast, but a whole series dedicated to what value for value is all about. So I'll put a link to his podcast in the show notes as well, so you can get a better handle on how that works and why I'm so enthusiastic about it. But if you want to get in touch with us, you can find me on Mastodon. I am at our podcast at podcastindex.social. And you can find me cross-posting this episode on LinkedIn as well. And of course, that other thing that sounds, again, maybe not so PG, the actual name of it, but hey, you know what it is. So in any event, that's where you can find me. And Mike, where can listeners find you?
Best place right now is Mastodon at mike_thomas@fastodon.org.
Awesome stuff. Well, another terrific episode. And yeah, really excited to close out the year with some more awesome R content in the last weeks of 2023. So we'll close up here. Thanks for listening, everybody, and we will be back with another episode of R Weekly Highlights next week.